Heart-related health problems affect millions of people each year. Maybe you're one of the many who suffer from issues related to angina pain, high blood pressure, congestive heart failure, unbalanced cholesterol, irregular heartbeat, or clogged arteries. There is a solution that doesn't involve expensive prescription drugs that only mask the problem and leave you with horrible side effects. If you are ready to live your life free of sickness, pain, and fear, live your life with increased vitality, energy, and youthfulness, and experience your body healing itself, then you're ready for Heart and Body Extract from Healthy Hearts Club. Heart and Body Extract has a 23-year proven track record of using certified organic herbs that make up an excellent formula to balance and support the heart and circulatory system. In as little as 2 weeks, you can feel amazing results when your 2-month supply of Heart and Body Extract today. Call 1-866-295-5305 or go to hbextract.com.
Have you ever wanted to learn where you can get free food and medicine from the plants growing around your neighborhood? Or how to turn your own backyard into a food production center? Or even how to reverse cancers using the latest groundbreaking research in alternative cancer therapies? You can learn all this and more from webseed.com. It's sort of like Netflix, but it's for documentaries and how-to courses on natural health, food production, self-reliance, and other life-saving topics. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, and I created Webseed so that listeners like you could get instant streaming access to truly groundbreaking instructional courses. Our new program called Vaccines Armed and Dangerous exposes the total fraud of modern vaccine quackery. And our Surthrival course teaches emergency preparedness, including skills like how to build your own emergency water filter. Explore over 100 valuable courses and documentaries right now at WEBSEED.com.
Do you know someone who can benefit from this radio program? You can find the complete archives of this show and hundreds of others at naturalnewsradio.com. Just send your friend that link, naturalnewsradio.com, where they will find truly amazing interviews and information that simply isn't published anywhere else. In the Natural News Radio archives, you'll find interviews with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Senator Rand Paul, Governor Jesse Ventura, Suzanne Summers, alternative cancer doctors, nutrition experts, preparedness experts, and a wealth of others. And it's all free. Listen in real time at naturalnewsradio.com or download the MP3 archive files anytime you want to listen on your phone, mobile devices, or personal computer. When you want articles on these topics, check out naturalnews.com with over 35,000 article pages on nutrition, natural cures, health freedom, and much more. It's all part of the Natural News Network. Thanks for listening.
And if it happens today, then you can be sure that it's going to be a lot worse. And it's just not being, it's not being discussed enough. It's not being covered enough, the solar maximum. And it's only a few people are really talking about it, like my friend Matt Stein. And some of you listeners are familiar with Matt. He's been on the show a couple of times. He's a mechanical engineer, has a degree in mechanical engineering from MIT, and he's been writing an awful lot about these things, and he wrote the book When Technology Fails. And anyway, you know, he's the only person I know who's out there actually kicking up a fuss, and now FlareAware is responding to the needs that people have in terms of knowing what's going on with the sun and what kind of activity, what kind of class of flares are being emitted and, you know, coronal mass ejections and whatnot. And anyway, I just wanted to mention that because, you know, I've been meeting a lot of really cool people lately. You know, I've been coming across some really cool stuff, you know, First Awareness Act, you know, which is a great, venue or it's a great, it's not a forum. It's a social network and for patriots and you know, that thing is a great idea. I've got a page on there, Survival and Beyond page, and you can go and check that out on Awareness Act. And, you know, there's always great people there who've given me a lot of great feedback for the show. So I like to support them. I like to support these things. When I meet people who are doing cool things and they're, you know, they're getting the truth out and they're getting the information out to people that, you know, to help them, you know, I want to promote them. So there's that. There's my unpaid plug. Absolutely no recompense for mentioning them at all. They're just good folks, and I'm happy to be working with them. And next week you can expect George and Brooksy Plimel to come on the show, and we're going to have an interview, and, you know, they can tell us way more about their gig and what FlareAware is all about. So, but in the meantime, if you want to go and check out their website, then yeah, it's FlareAware.com. And I'm gonna move on. I'm gonna gracefully segue into the next subject. And since I was talking about Awareness Act, one of my listeners on Awareness Act sent me a message. James, I'm not gonna mention his full name. I don't know if he'd prefer or not, or doesn't care. But James, if you're listening, hey, what's up, man? And he was asking me, one of the messages that he sent me, he was asking me what my thoughts were about this march that's supposed to be going on in Washington, D.C. on the 5th of November. And, you know, when I had first heard about it, I didn't really pay too much attention to it. And then I you know, kind of forgot about it a little bit and then went away. And but, you know, I started looking into it a little bit. This whole deal where their spoken agenda is they're going to affect a citizen's arrest on all the members of Congress and the president for, you know, war crimes and, you know, crimes against the people and, you know, the Constitution. And you know, and of course, my first thought is, really? Great. Let me know how you plan to do that, because that's probably not going to happen. You know, and the other thing too is like this whole march, this whole idea is being spurned on or organized. I don't even know if you can call it organized because of the nature of Anonymous. Anonymous is apparently the body behind this march, and yeah, so they're going to march in, and they have somewhat of a manifesto, which. It seems like I've read a manifesto like this before. you know, they talk about taking over all the corporations and dividing ownership amongst the employees, and board members don't have any say anymore. And, you know, the employees are the owners. And, you know, that sounds kind of like Viva la Proletariat. You know, that sounds a little like, you know, a little too much like communism to me. You know, it's like, I'm not a big fan of corporations, like I told James in my response, but I'm even less of a fan of redistribution of wealth. So that doesn't give me a good vibe about it. And, you know, and it's backed or it's being promoted by Anonymous. And, you know, I've never really come to a conclusion as to how I feel about the group Anonymous. You know, you see their videos and everything, and sometimes you can't even tell if you're seeing a real Anonymous video or a fake Anonymous video. And we don't know anything about Anonymous, you know, and that's just the truth. I mean, you know, whenever somebody comes up and they start talking about liberty and freedom, and then, you know, we immediately assume that, you know, they're on our side or we're on their side or whatever way you look at it, you know, but if you're not careful about who you fall in line with, then you can end up finding out that the group that you thought was fighting for the people and fighting for freedom was actually started by George Soros, or a bunch of communists. Anonymous could be, they could be a bunch of communists. I guess one of their platforms is they don't have any kind of affiliation with, anything that's any kind of organization or group or, political view or anything like that. But that kind of talk about taking over corporations and dividing it up among the employees, that just doesn't sit well with me. I mean, where does that end? That sounds kind of, communist manifesto type fodder. So I'm kind of leery about to get back to what my opinion is of it. I'm kind of leery about that march. It sounds like a great way to get yourself arrested, because I don't really see how they're going to impose a citizen's arrest on Congress and the president. But you might get arrested yourself. And don't get me wrong. When I would go to protests and demonstrations and whatever you want to call them, part of me always hoped I'd get arrested. So then I can go online and basically show the world what a freaking martyr I am or whatever. But it doesn't really matter. And again, this is all stuff that I said to James in response to his question about what I thought of the whole march thing and what my opinion was about it. And that's basically my opinion you might get arrested and so what? It's not really going to make a difference. It's like I likened it to wetting yourself in a dark suit, going to protests and whatnot. I mean, you feel really good and you get a nice warm feeling, but nobody really notices. And even though that this march is being promoted as or it's being pointed out that this is not a protest, it's an action. I don't know. I don't know about. Even if I wanted to go to this thing, I couldn't go, to this thing because I'm just my schedule doesn't allow it. I'm pretty much a one man operation around here, and I've got my plate full at all times. And one of my favorite expressions when people ask me what's happening, what's going on, just juggling cats, man. I'm just juggling cats around here. Trying to keep up with the website and the show, and I got lots of things going on. I'm trying to get as much information as I can out, but I'm also the webmaster, and I have to be the technical guy, and I'm not what anybody would consider an expert in that regard. So when stuff happens, I got to figure it out myself, and that's time consuming. It's always a learning curve for me. So. But it's well worth it. It's a labor of love. I do this, because I feel it's important and because I feel like this is information that people ought to know about. And we need as many voices as possible, I think, to, effectively cause a reverberation large enough to wake enough people up and get people to change their reality. And there was something, this reminds me of a little, a footnote, that crossed my mind, something that I was thinking about in terms of, we're going to wrap this up pretty soon because we're going to take a break, in a minute, but wrapping up this or tying this into the whole manifestation, principle is, Everett's many worlds theory. And it's something I haven't thought about in a while, but I think about it from time to time. And Everett's many worlds theory is basically a postulation by a quantum scientist, a quantum physicist, that there are actually numerous worlds, or to put it differently, there are numerous realities that exist simultaneously, and that every time that you make a decision, it creates another branch. It creates another reality. So there's, you know, like the, if you turn left instead of right, well, there is one reality where you turned left and another one where you turned right. And then everything else that happened from that point forward and unfolded in completely different ways. And really all it takes is thought to, and this is something to wrap your head around, you know, all it really takes is thought for you to change worlds, to step from one world into another, because your thoughts, your decisions, the things that you decide to do, ultimately direct the flow of your life. Well, you're saying, well, yeah, that's obvious that of course our decisions affect the outcomes of our lives, but you can choose. The point I'm getting is you can choose. You can choose if this is the world that you want to live in. You can decide not to live in this world. You can just live in a different world where you just create your own reality, you know? And if Everett's theory, which was roundly dismissed when he was alive, when he first came up with this, you know, all of his contemporaries despised it. They thought it was nonsense, you know, but now it's starting to gain some respect. You know, people are in the quantum physics world are reexamining this, and because of the things that have been discovered since, he came up with this theory, I think back in the 70s. I'm not really sure. And he died shortly thereafter. And so he never got to experience the notoriety that is starting to arise from it. But the many worlds theory, it's, you know, it's something to keep in the back of your head. You know, it's like every time you make a decision, you know, it creates a new world. And in doing such, you can probably step from one world to another and from that world to another one. And, you know, again, it all comes down to manifesting, you know. So anyway, I don't know if that made a bit of sense at all. Makes perfect sense in my head, but you know, sometimes words are inadequate to describe certain things and philosophies. But we got to take a break. I'm running really late on the break, and we've got to give some love to our sponsors. Without the sponsors, there wouldn't be a show. So just hang tight, and we'll be right back.
Silver has been in use as an effective antimicrobial for thousands of years, and this old technology is still in use today. In 2001, a patent was approved for a new medical silver application, nanocatalytic silver hydrosols. Unlike conventional colloidal silver products, some of the advantages of nanosilver include up to 300% greater bioavailability, proven non-toxicity in over 25 university and FDA-approved laboratory studies, and extreme stability with a shelf life of over 10 years. Guarantee. With just one product, you can replace all the antibiotics, wound and burn dressings, and water purification products in your medical bug-out bag. These products have been patented for use against some of the deadliest pathogens known, many that are resistant to traditional antibiotics, yet are safe and gentle enough for treating a baby's diaper rash. To learn more about this medical silver breakthrough and see the published scientific studies, visit www.lifesilver.com. All orders ship within 24 hours with deep discounts and free shipping for case orders. That's www.lifesilver.com.
American gardeners and fellow patriots, make the right choice with your money, time, and your family food supply. Choose 100% pure heirloom seeds in the Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com. Why spend more? The Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com is only $37.95 and includes 20 varieties of pure, hardy, easy-to-grow heirloom seeds. Yes, only $37.95. That's 70% less than our competitors. You could buy three Survival Seed Vaults for less than one of theirs. The Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com includes detailed planting and seed saving instructions and ships same day. Plus, all orders over $49 ship free. MyPatriotSupply.com is American owned by patriots like you, passionate about freedom and preparedness. Call now, 866-229-0927. That's 866-229-0927. Or discover more emergency preparedness items when you order at MyPatriotSupply.com. Choose the original. Choose the Survival Seed Vault at MyPatriotSupply.com.
Survival is not about the end of the world. It's not about a hypothetical plane crash or the latest violent storm. Survival is about the satisfaction of knowing you can take care of yourself and your family in any situation, anytime, anywhere. CampingSurvival.com was started in 1956. No, not the .com part, the survival part. CampingSurvival.com has over 17,000 urban, wilderness, and preparedness items. Supreme customer service, very low shipping, and no games. We look around to make sure we have the lowest prices. And CampingSurvival.com is 100% USMC veteran-owned. Don't base your survival on the latest spring up on the internet company. Do business with an authority on survival. CampingSurvival.com. Confidence born on preparation.
Okay, and we're back here on Survival and Beyond, and I just want to remind you folks that you can get 5% off all of your purchases at CampingSurvival.com by entering the coupon code SBRadio. That's S as in survival, B as in beyond, and the word radio. All one word, no spaces, SBRadio. Get 5% off at CampingSurvival.com. Go get yours now. Now that we've had our sponsor, love, we're going to get right into another topic that's been concerning. And well, it's a concern. It's on so many different levels. I don't even know where to start. But this whole election deal, you know, is there going to even be an election? You know, that's what a lot of people are talking about, and myself included. You know, I wouldn't be afraid to bet that, you know, the election could be suspended from what I've been seeing going on and what I've been hearing other people talking about. You know, last week we had Gary Yantis on the show, author of Infinite Dangers, and he goes and does a lot of research on stuff. And if you didn't hear last week's show, you can listen to it on survivalandbeyond.net. And just go to the show archives, and all of the previous shows are listed there for your listening enjoyment or downloading pleasure. A nice little plug for the website, right? That was slick. So anyway, you know, a lot of people are talking about whether there's going to be what they call an October surprise, which, you know, on first blush, you would think that there would be some kind of hostilities, some kind of false flag event. It could be a bank collapse. It could be, there's all kinds of predictions going on out there. But a lot of people also are predicting some civil unrest if this election doesn't turn out the way that Obama supporters would like it to, if Mitt Romney ends up winning, or, you know, if Gary Johnson ends up winning. Oh boy, there's going to be a lot of people who, I think it could go either way. I'm not saying that, that it's just the Democrats that'll freak out if Obama loses, but they will freak out. I don't know if Republicans would freak out as much, but I think freedom fighters, you and I and people who are concerned for liberty, would definitely freak out if Obama won another term, you know. And it's really, you know, I hate to say it, I've really been struggling with this, with my beliefs about, voting and, you know, making a difference. But when you vote, yeah, you don't really feel like it makes a difference, you know. I mean, there's all kinds of, I think the game is rigged, you know. I think the game's been rigged for a while. And, I've gone back and forth with this in my life. You know, in my younger days, I didn't really think about voting. You know, I didn't participate in the process, in the electoral process, as it were. And my reasoning for doing that, or my rationalization, was that, it doesn't really matter. And, you know, the rest of the world, I wasn't fully awake, but I knew the world was kind of, you know, insane and psychopathic. And I knew there was just, you know, a lot of bad mojo going on, but I didn't want to have anything to do with it. And so I decided, you know, I used to have these arguments with really politically active people my own age. I'm talking about like when I was in my 20s, you know. And they're saying, oh, well, you know, our forefathers died for us to have the right to vote. And yeah, that's true. But they also died for me to choose not to vote if I don't want to, or if I don't think it matters, or whatever. And then when I woke up, I became very, very involved and very active and very in favor of voting and encouraging people to vote and voting myself and, you know, participating in that whole system. But, you know, after a while, again, you know, right now, just looking at the caucuses and all the voting fraud that was uncovered and how Ron Paul was like really muscled out of the convention and Ron Paul followers. And, you know, Ron Paul had been muscled out of previous caucuses and previous events all along the campaign trail. And, you know that the system is rigged. You know that it's just set up to work for, you know, the two sides of the same coin, the two heads of the same beast, the illusion of choice, the illusion that it makes a difference and that it matters. And, you know, until there's really, I will never get up here and encourage people not to vote, you know, but I have to admit that I do have my, my misgivings and my frustrations about the whole thing myself, you know, and I will vote in the presidential election, but, you know, I don't have faith anymore. I don't have faith that it makes a difference or that it matters. And there's an expression for, you know, people who vote and they know it doesn't make a difference. You know, probably, just a dummy, you know, just as flawed as all the people who think there is a difference between Obama and Romney. And I think it's a choice between Hitler and Stalin. You know, it's like, which dictator do you want? And the reason why a lot of people are afraid, I mean, you know, obviously the Department of Homeland Security is concerned, you know, enough so because, as we all know, you know, I've been really just harping on this issue about DHS buying up all this ammunition, and I've laid off the subject for a little while because, you know, I don't want to burn people out. But the thing is, if it didn't continue to happen, if they didn't keep buying more and more ammunition, then I would have shut up about it, you know. But it wasn't like I was flogging a dead horse and just pointing at one event. I mean, they just kept buying up more and more, and it was amazing, you know. And also, obviously, they're preparing for something, you know, and they're in a big hurry, and I think they want to get everything in place for the election, because really, frankly, there can be civil unrest, and there can be nationwide, possibly, you know. I'm speculating here, but regardless of who wins, if the election does come to fruition, as some people are predicting, it won't. So the other thing is that there are going to be UN observers at various voting locations across the country. And the reasoning for that is that they're there to observe conservative voters and I guess be on guard in case there's a conservative uprising of unrest, either at the voting booths or at the or after the election results are declared. I'm not sure which, but that's highly unsettling. Anytime that I hear about United Nations, about foreign troops on American soil, there's no excuse for it. There's no reason for that to happen at all. And I don't care if they said it was 44 observers, 44 UN observers were going to be observing at the voting booths. And I don't care if it's 44. I don't care if it's four. I don't care if it's one. There is no reason for the UN to have anything to do with our private presidential elections. This is not a UN issue. I mean, you know, they're not the world government yet. And if I have my say about it, they never will be. But you know, this is, there's a lot of speculation that, and something that I've known from the beginning, which, and some of it I'm going to get into later because this has to do with another, another story or another topic that I've been following and I think it's important. But, you know, we have a UN, the first UN president. Obama is the first UN president of the United States. He's completely in compliance with Agenda 21 and all of the things that are in harmony with this whole plan to take control over resources in the United States, to corral people into, I've been calling them human habitation zones. I think they're, I think the way the UN phrases it, the way Agenda 21 phrases it, is population centers or population zones, where they want everybody to live in urban areas near public transportation, not drive cars, and just have everything, make it so that everything that we need, we cannot have access to it. We need to, it has to come, it will have to come through the government. We will not be able to grow our own food. We will not be able to utilize natural resources or, you know, wilderness resources. We will not be able to do anything for ourselves. And that's the way the UN wants it. And this is a real thing, man. You know, I keep feeling the need to have to say this and to repeat this, that Agenda 21 is real, and it's a big cause for concern. It's not something that you can just pass off as the, you know, as I did, you know, just pass it off as that's the greenie, you know, movement and everything. It is not about saving the environment. It is not about sustainable development or, you know, smart development or anything like that. You know, it is about control, and it's about, you know, when the UN gets to decide who gets access to resources and who doesn't, when they want to clear out and prevent people from living in rural areas and blocking off access to, you know, the rural land and taking over farms and handing it over to big agro, you know, the government's going to come in, and part of the rural council that Obama signed, you know, the federal government has the authority to, you know, basically come in and tell people or direct the use of rural resources and rural lands. And I'm sure that they're going to come in and start saying, you know what, we know better how to run this farmland than you do. And, you know, even though you've been farming this property for generations, it doesn't matter. You know, I think we know how to utilize and how and what's the word? It'll come to me when it's irrelevant. It usually does. The stewardship. Yeah. Individuals cannot be trusted, according to the government, in the stewardship of natural resources. And so therefore the government has to come in and tell people what's what and get people to, you know, move out and relocate them. And that's what all the population zones thing is about. And, you know, we're going to have a UN president, but like I said, I'm not going to, get to the real meat of that bone, the real meat of that bone that I'm going to pick later on after the break is an issue that really I'm not going to describe it now because, you know, it doesn't matter. I'm going to be talking about it in a few minutes. Anyway, we're going to have a UN president. We have a president who's always been in compliance with United Nations mandates. And so that's what we have to look forward to, you know, if Obama gets reselected as president. And this is going to be a problem. This is going to be a problem if martial law is declared and all of a sudden, you know, we've got swarms of UN troops telling Americans, you know, what's what, and busting in their homes and everything. Because our own troops, well, first of all, our own troops are so spread out, you know, we got most of our troops making the Middle East safe for corporatism and consumerism and in, international control of the banking system. That's what all of that is all about in reality. There's not a Rothschild's bank in Iran yet, so that's where our next target is going to be. But that's probably not going to happen until after the elections. So, yeah, we've got all this cooking up and brewing up, and so we're here I go again. You know, yes, I did drop the ball for a second, but I did pick it up. Now I know where I remembered where I was going with this. The thing about it is our troops are spread too thin, and so it's going to have to be UN troops, foreign troops, whatever, that if martial law is enacted, that's what it's going to be. And the way that the Department of Homeland Surveillance has been gearing up, you know, it's probably going to be something even greater than that. FEMA, after all, is initially or primarily concerned with continuity of government. It is like a shadow government. Most of their funding goes into black ops and not disaster preparedness, not disaster readiness or any kind of aid or assistance, you know, in a disaster. That's a very small amount of their budget goes towards that. And most of it is geared towards all of these black ops and all of these systems in ensuring the continuity of government, in which case, if that happens, there is no constitution. Once they take over there, it's martial law, and that's that. Your rights are gone. So there's a lot of interesting speculation about what is going to or what could possibly transpire in the next in the next couple of weeks. You know, it's not the election's not too much further away. You know, speaking to you now on the 24th. I can't spend any more time speculating on it right now, because we do have to take another break to give our sponsors some love. They help keep the show going. So hang tight. We'll be right back.
Do you know someone who can benefit from this radio program? You can find the complete archives of this show and hundreds of others at naturalnewsradio.com. Just send your friend that link, naturalnewsradio.com, where they will find truly amazing interviews and information that simply isn't published anywhere else. In the Natural News Radio archives, you'll find interviews with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Senator Rand Paul, Governor Jesse Ventura, Suzanne Summers, alternative cancer doctors, nutrition experts, preparedness experts, and a wealth of others. And it's all free. Listen in real time at naturalnewsradio.com or download the MP3 archive files anytime you want to listen on your phone, mobile devices, or personal computer. When you want articles on these topics, check out naturalnews.com with over 35,000 article pages on nutrition, natural cures, health freedom, and much more. It's all part of the Natural News Network. Thanks for listening.
Heart-related health problems affect millions of people each year. Maybe you're one of the many who suffer from issues related to angina pain, high blood pressure, congestive heart failure, unbalanced cholesterol, irregular heartbeat, or clogged arteries. There is a solution that doesn't involve expensive prescription drugs that only mask the problem and leave you with horrible side effects. If you are ready to live your life free of sickness, pain, and fear, live your life with increased vitality, energy, and youthfulness, and experience your body healing itself, then you're ready for Heart and Body Extract from Healthy Hearts Club. Heart and Body Extract has a 23-year proven track record of using certified organic herbs that make up an excellent formula to balance and support the heart and circulatory system. In as little as 2 weeks, you can feel amazing results when your 2-month supply of Heart and Body Extract today. Call 1-866-295-5305 or go to hbextract.com.
Have you ever wanted to learn where you can get free food and medicine from the plants growing around your neighborhood? Or how to turn your own backyard into a food production center? Or even how to reverse cancers using the latest groundbreaking research in alternative cancer therapies? You can learn all this and more from webseed.com. It's sort of like Netflix, but it's for documentaries and how-to courses on natural health, food production, self-reliance, and other life-saving topics. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, and I created Webseed. seed so that listeners like you could get instant streaming access to truly groundbreaking instructional courses. Our new program called Vaccines Armed and Dangerous exposes the total fraud of modern vaccine quackery. And our Surthrival course teaches emergency preparedness, including skills like how to build your own emergency water filter. Explore over 100 valuable courses and documentaries right now at WEBSEED.com.
Okay, and we're back. And, you know, getting on with the subject about the election and everything, you know, all you can really do, you know, with all that rhetoric and all the argument that's going on back and forth is, you know, about, you know, like if you don't vote for one of the other, one or the other, if you don't vote for Romney, basically, to actually get down to the crux of the biscuit, if you don't vote for Romney, then that's a vote for Obama, you know, meaning that, you know, if you vote for Gary Johnson or you write in Ron Paul, then somehow you're helping Obama win the election. Well, when it comes right down to it, you have to be true to yourself and you have to be true to your beliefs and your feelings, and you have to be true to what you think is right, you know? And so I'm not going to go out there and holler at people that, you know, they have to vote for, they have to continue to believe the fantasy, the illusion of a two-party system. You know, I'll never tell anybody that, you know, a vote for anybody but Romney is a vote for Obama. You know, that's really what you have to do at the end of the day, because I wrangled with it. You know, I wrangled over and over, and it's like, well, you know, if you don't vote for Romney, then that means that, you know, you're going to usher another 4 years of his dictatorship into the White House. And, you know, but you just can't, you have to vote with your heart. You have to vote with your mind, with your intellect. Like I said, what you feel is right. So, you know, if you write in Ron Paul, hey, that's great. You know, you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. You're voting your conscience. And if you vote for Gary Johnson, then super, you know, that's great as well. And that's who I'm going to be voting for. I'm going to be voting for Gary Johnson. You know, I toyed around a bit with the idea of doing the write-in for Ron Paul, but, you know, you can't overanalyze these things too much. The fact is that Ron Paul is not running, you know, and I agree with a lot of Gary Johnson's, principles, what I've heard of him. And he's, definitely, you know, a libertarian, a true libertarian is better than anything in the position that we're having these pantomime elections for. But, anyway, I wanted to move on with, and hey, if anybody, you know, if you have any points to add, or if you have any, opinions or suggestions, or not really suggestions, but, you know, or if you agree or disagree, you know, let me know. Like I said, hit the comment section. I'd love to hear from my listeners, and it's good to know that, you know, it's always gratifying to me when one of you guys sends me a message. You know, it's good to know that I'm actually reaching people out there, you know. Because sometimes I'll tell you, especially with the show being pre-recorded, and, you know, I'd love to be able to take phone calls, you know, and do a live show as it is right now. You know, that's not really feasible at the moment. It's not off the table. You know, I may do a live show again in the future, but anyway, the point I'm getting at is, you know, when you do a show like this, oftentimes it feels like you're talking to yourself. And it certainly does, because you literally are talking to yourself. I'm talking and speaking into my microphone, and my nice new microphone, by the way. I don't know if anybody noticed the last few shows, although I'm still trying to get a handle on it. You know, like I said, I wear all the hats around here, but yeah, I got a nice new microphone, and it really makes my voice sound a lot better. I don't know if it's carrying out to you guys or whatever, but so that's cool. It's a completely pointless thing for me to talk about my microphone. I actually, it didn't Alex Jones go off about his microphone at one time. I seem to have a vague memory of that, but yeah, I don't know. Sometimes I just go off on a tangent, but I need to keep an eye on my time too. I hate it when I get down to the last minutes and going into the second segment of the show. I have to split my attention between what I'm talking about and the clock that's running and make sure that I don't go over my time or I don't fall under my time. So what, but anyway, yeah, before I go into more verbal diarrhea, geez, criminy. One issue that I wanted to talk about today that I think is, it's something that, you know, I've been going off about a lot of aspects of this, this particular issue, and that is energy and the cost of energy and the cost of food. But more to the point, cap and trade, which is, it's basically Obama's baby, you know, the cap and trade bill. I mean, he cooked this up back when he was in the Senate, and it's been going through Congress, and it's been transformed and rewritten and been renamed and had all kinds of, you know, changes affected to it. But it's still out there, and it's still quite alive. And I believe that the latest version of cap and they're not calling it cap and trade anymore, because, you know, there's a lot of when that name was being used, there was a lot of blowback from, well, basically critical thinking, liberty minded individuals that, you know, cap and trade is just a regressive tax. That by Obama's admission, his own admission, when he was a senator, he said, my plan will necessarily make energy costs skyrocket. And this is what he wants. And this is what I was talking about earlier in the show when I was mentioning that we have a UN president who is really going out of his way to comply with all the Agenda 21 mandates, you know, starting with, well, it's probably not even starting with the Rural Council. The rural, I hate that word, rural. I'm from New England and we tend to not pronounce our R's. The Rural Council Act, and that's in pure harmonization with Agenda 21 protocols. And so is cap and trade, you know. I mean, this whole fervor that continues to burn on about saving the environment and about our carbon footprint and, you know, carbon emissions and, oh, what we're doing to the atmosphere and we're killing the planet and everything. And even though all that junk science that was supporting the whole global warming and climate change, the human-caused global warming rhetoric or climate change rhetoric, even though that information was found to be cooked data and not true science at all, and everybody knows this, even still, the EPA and all these other agencies and protection groups and everything have been just continuing to brainwash us into believing that we are killing the planet and we should accept any and all suggestions or, you know, we should support all measures to put an end to that and make all the sacrifices that, you know, that we can make to ensure that we stop destroying the planet. All right. Now, don't get me wrong. And I feel like I always have to qualify this. I always have to make this qualification, because invariably, whenever anybody hears me talking about, you know, protecting the environment in the way that I just was, I invariably get people who say, oh, so you think that, you know, we should just be totally disregard, you know, the environment. No, I don't think that we should totally disregard the environment. I do not think that we are not having an effect at all on our environment. I think that this whole environmental, or this, you know, protecting of the environment, or this the global climate change, you know, it's a hoax. Basically, it's a hoax, just to get it get it down there simply. And it's a hoax that's it's not about saving the planet. It's about control, you know, because now everybody's got to get smart meters on their houses, apparently. You know, and those smart meters, you know, all it's going to do, this is a device that nobody asked for. It benefits nobody, absolutely no one. And yet it's the you know, it has to be done. And it first started in California and it's been moving all across the country. I think smart meters are now starting to show up in all parts of the country. And the system that we had for metering our electricity worked just fine, right? There's no reason to replace it. You know, it's fixing something that ain't broke. The reason why they're doing this is because this puts you in a grid. This puts you in a communications grid with the smart meters, essentially like a cell tower. And you know, there's also the health considerations. This is like having a cell phone transmitter that's broadcasting all the time attached to your house. And there's all kinds of health ramifications with that. I am very wary of cell phone, the radiation that you get exposed to by holding a cell phone to your head. I don't do that. I use a Bluetooth. And Craig Green, he's another expert that's been on the show. He's been on the show a couple of times. Or I think he was on my old show. He hasn't been on this show yet. But he's one of the biggest, he's one of the most knowledgeable experts in communications that I know. And this guy's been in the communications business for over 30 years, and he knows his stuff. He knows his stuff from, you know, radio waves to, you know, what have you, satellite, you know, communications, you know, the whole thing. And yeah, and he is absolutely thoroughly convinced that the radiation you get from using a cell phone putting up to your head is devastating. Nobody should be doing that. You know, he told me in a private conversation, we started talking about Bluetooth, and I mentioned that because I didn't know for sure if it was really, you know, protecting me by any measurable degree, or if it just made me feel better. And he said that the radiation that you get from a Bluetooth signal is an order of magnitude less than what you're getting just slammed with when you put that phone up to your head. So you have that to look forward to when you have a smart meter on your house. And what it does is it transmits data from one meter to another, and it's all part of the grid. It's part of a matrix that records your energy usage habits, of course, and, you know, when you use the most electricity, when you use the least electricity. And some people are concerned that it can tell when you're not at home, and that there's more personal information that's being broadcast out there about you that you don't want. I mean, any amount of information, you know, is like you have to ask yourself, well, why do they need to know, you know, what my usage habits are and whatnot? And there's all kinds of, you know, very valid sounding justifications for that. But, you know, it all ties into the whole, you know, smart development, eco-friendly, you know, rhetoric, the whole brainwashing campaign. We want to help you, you know, unburden the planet from your carbon footprint or whatever. And people will buy into this stuff. They will buy into the smart meters. They will buy into it with this warm, fuzzy feeling, knowing that they're doing their part to save the planet and all this. And they're not even going to get critical or look into the real dangers, both, you know, physical, you know, medical dangers and also the privacy dangers involved. This network is completely exposed. Just about anybody would be able to hack into the smart meter network without much difficulty. And it just so happens that this really starts to fall in line with the UN Agenda 21 mandates to initiate an action, not a suggestion, not a regulation, but to go into action on a global level to help reduce consumption and reduce energy consumption. And what the overreaching plan is they want everybody to move out. They want everybody to live in the population zones, you know, and just basically take over. And that's what cap and trade is also going to do. It's going to put numerous businesses out of business. They're not going to be able to keep their doors open. And this actually now this brings us around to the point that I wanted to bring up. And it's just in time, too, as a matter of fact, checking how I'm doing on the clock. But so this I belabor that point, or I went through all of that. I made you listen to all of that foreshadowing, and that's what it was foreshadowing, just to illustrate that, you know, this is a subject that I've been on top of. And, well, I was more on top of it a couple of years ago, especially cap and trade, because it's going to be disastrous. It's going to be disastrous for everybody. Small businesses will have a hard time keeping their doors open because, you know, they'll have carbon limits and this whole notion about corporations exchanging carbon credits and all this other stuff. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It really is. It's nonsensical. It's put out there so that, you know, you can rub your chin and say, that makes sense, or, you know, oh, that might work, or whatever, you know. But it's a farce. So really what it's all about is jacking up energy prices. It's a regressive tax. And then the way the whole rest of the system works with the Federal Reserve and, you know, inflation and all that. And once energy prices get really uncomfortable, when they get really prohibitive, that's when you're going to start to see supply lines getting interrupted, you know, food deliveries not really making it. Because, you know, when energy prices go up, then it makes the cost of everything go up. You know, they're tied together intrinsically. You cannot separate, you know, the cost of energy from everything else, because that's just the world we live in, folks. And, you know, we talk a lot about in the survival and preparedness genre, if it can be called a genre, we talk a lot about really catastrophic events, disaster level events, you know, that will hurl us back into the 19th century, or hurl us back into the dark ages, or whatever. And they're always, and we talk a lot about the really epic, you know, exciting things like, well, exciting, it seems even wrong to say, you know, use that word exciting, but, you know, we talk about grid collapse, or we talk about solar flares, or we talk about, you know, civil unrest and all of these tumultuous economic collapse, and, you know, all these really, you know, tumultuous toppling events. But what, you know, could really do us in is just the rising cost of energy and the rising cost of food, which will, like I said, goes hand in hand. And like I said, I've always had this concern, but, you know, then I end up focusing on other things, and, you know, I know cap and trade is out there, but it's, you know, that snake ain't moving too much right now. After Obama gets elected, you can bet that he will be very energetic in pushing forward with cap and trade. And something that brought it home to me, this whole situation, you know, when energy prices start rising, food prices start rising, food prices are going up right now. I'm sure you're all seeing it. I'm seeing it. It's going up, you know, drastically. Portions are getting smaller. And that in itself is a good reason to get prepared, you know, just to save yourself some money in the future that you won't have to pay when the prices go up so exponentially high that it, you know, it'll be unbelievable. So that in itself is enough reason to store food. But with the rising cost of food and the rising cost of, and the matching, you know, climb in the cost of fuel, like I said, supply lines will get interrupted, and eventually food will become so expensive and so scarce that a lot of people may end up having to make a choice between whether they eat, whether they put food on the table, or whether they pay their electric bill or their heating bill, you know. And if it gets, there's no reason to think that if cap and trade goes into effect, that it will get that bad, that fuel prices, energy, electricity will just be out of reach it'll be too expensive, and the food will be too expensive, and you have to make a decision somewhere. And, you know, I know what I would choose. I'd say, yeah, let the power be turned off, you know. But this could happen on an epidemic scale in the United States with the way the economy is right now and people are struggling. If things keep on getting worse, we're going to find massive amounts of Americans, millions perhaps, of Americans who whose homes go dark. And people today, the average person today, has really no idea what it means to live without electricity. And when you don't have access to a stove, you know, how are you going to cook your food? How are you going to keep warm in the wintertime, you know, without asphyxiating yourself? Because many of the homes that we live in now are not equipped for, you know, they're not equipped with fire, with a fireplace or a wood stove or any of, you know, or if you live in an apartment, you know, your home is just not equipped to live in any other kind of society, any, you know, other than, you know, on-demand utilities, on-demand power, you know, any other existence that you would have to live after that, where you have to cook your food over a fire, where you have to use fire to keep your home warm, you know, a world lit by fire. And that could possibly happen here, where just people end up reverting to a very feudal, serf-like existence. And only the very wealthy will be able to afford to heat and power their homes. And that's what I'm getting to. And that's what brings me to this article that I talked about, or that I mentioned. And it was from the Intel Hub, written by Kimberly Paxton. And, you know, props go out to you, Kim. And it's a great article, and it's available. You can read it on survivalandbeyond.net. And I posted it up there, and I thought that the thing, it was chilling. Reading this article was really chilling. It really brought the reality of it home, and it reminded me, you know, like, hey, I kind of, you know, forgot about that and started focusing on other things, mostly, you know, the Department of Homeland Surveillance and all of the other immediate or seemingly more immediate dangers that are confronting our liberty and our freedom. And this really is like, I don't think I ever really thought of it in this way. I mean, you know, intellectually, you know, like, yeah, things are going to get bad. Things will get rough if food keeps on rising, if the cost of food keeps on rising and energy and all that. But, you know, imagine like entire towns or neighborhoods where people are living a very, like I said, feudal life, no power, you know, in the suburbs, all across the country, you know. And people are going to suffer because they're not equipped. They don't have the knowledge. They don't have the resources. And this is where I see it going. Okay, I'm trying to formulate this so I put this out succinctly. Where I see it going is once people have had enough, when the winter comes and they can't heat their homes and they can't get food, you know, the supermarkets, you know, eventually it'll get harder and harder to keep product on the shelves, and supermarkets will eventually close their doors, and then you'll be left to fend for yourself, and not many people are going to be able to do that, and not many people are going to have food storage. So they're going to turn to the government for help. It's only natural. And of course the government will oblige by giving them housing and shelter in one of these population zones. You know, just start the herding, start the roundup, you know. And that, you know, I don't identify myself as a conspiracy theorist, but it does seem almost seems like that they know exactly what they're doing. Like, there are all of these nooses that are slowly constricting around our necks, and there's so many of them that could, you know, just demolish our way of life that we aren't aware of them all, or I don't even think we could possibly be aware of them all. You know, like I said, we talk about the big things, the obvious things, but I really, again, you know, like, I'm not a doomer. I don't like to scare people. I don't like to frighten people, but you know, these kind of things, it's quite likely to happen. It's not a far-fetched scenario in the least. And especially if we go to war with Iran, and which in all likelihood we probably will over this phony, you know, we're getting bamboozled by the weapons of mass destruction lie again. But we go to war with Iran, you know, don't even think this won't affect oil prices. You know, every time there's a little saber rattling, it affects oil prices, just because when tensions get high, the cost of gas goes up. You know, that's when you start to see the gas go up. Like recently, you know, the gas prices are starting to go down now, but, you know, for a while there, it was climbing up towards $4, did hit $4 in a lot of states. And this is all due to just tensions in the area and speculation. So if we're at war with Iran, you can bet that gas is going to be like at European price levels, which it's always been expensive in Europe, but, we're going to start feeling that. And, yeah, and it all seems, you know, it's almost hard to believe that it's not orchestrated, that it's not planned, it's not conspired, you know. But getting back to this article, it's called "What If Electricity Was Only for Rich People?" And like I said, Kimberly Paxton, great job, and she really hit all the nails on the head. About this, and you know, explaining how all of these things incorporate with each other, and how this is in synergy with Agenda 21, and how basically the government is saying one thing, and yet their actions are speaking otherwise, especially in cases with like GE and things like that, where companies are allowed to. You know, corporations are allowed to do whatever they want, and but they're going to put strictures on the American people and start telling them, no, you can't use your electricity. You can't use any more electricity today. You know, how about that? How about with your nifty new smart meter, right? That the government were able to just cut your power off without even having to go to the electric company. Just shut down your system. You know, I don't know that it's engineered like that, that if the smart meter shuts, well, it must be, if the smart meter shuts off, you ain't getting any more juice. You know, we all talk about like chips and we're all afraid of getting chipped, the RFID chip and everything. But in a manner of speaking, we've already been chipped and we're allowing ourselves to become even chipped even further. You know, first of all, the big thing that has us is money. You know, that is the low tech means by which we are being controlled, and everything is just another step towards that goal, towards that, you know, for complete control. And if they control your juice, your electricity, if they can come up with a bunch of mumbo jumbo legislation that allows them to tell you, you know, what your consumption can be and when they can turn you off and turn you back on again. Well, guess what? You know, it's like you're a little bit further into your prison. You're a little bit further into your slavery when that happens. And then it won't be long, you know, people will be suffering too long when the brownout across America or the gradual blackout, the grayout across America happens. People can't pay for their electricity anymore, and they'll turn to the government for help, and they'll end up walking right into the corral. They'll get herded up. They'll get herded up like sheep. And then you're given vouchers for food, and you're given, you know, everything is completely controlled. It's completely out of your hands. Where you live, you're told where to live. You're told how much food you can have. You're told how much consumption of energy you can, how much energy you can consume. And that's what your life is going to be like. So you see, it's not the big catastrophic things that we, you know, necessarily have to worry about. It's these gradual things that, you know, are creeping up around the sides and, you know, we're aware of it and it's in our periphery, but we don't, you know, we don't realize that one day we could wake up and say, you know, this, I can't afford the basics of living in a civilized world, in a first world nation. You know, we're going to see people, those are the kinds of things. Those are the kinds of things that'll get us when we're not looking, when we're not paying attention. You know, of course, we pay attention to the obvious things, to the overt things, to, you know, DHS buying up all the ammunition and explosives that it can, and all these really, you know, imminent, dangerous crises in the making that we can see going. But this is definitely something that we may not have to be taken out by martial law. There may not have to be a overt show of force to for the powers that be, for the dictatorship to commence. And in all honesty, in all rationality, I mean, the dictatorship has been going. It has been going on. It's been going on for a while now. Just nobody's made it official. You know, it hasn't been declared yet. But when it is declared, and you know, we're going to be controlled in ways that we really didn't give too much credit to, and I think that's what was chilling about that article, is that it wasn't really anything new, but it was put, it was seen from a certain perspective that I really hadn't considered before, where most of Americans can't afford to heat their homes, can't afford electricity, living like serfs, you know, and it's not bad enough that, you know, we're already serfs, you know, and I have no, how do I want to put it? You know, I have no qualms anymore about putting an awful lot of energy into making people realize that they're slaves, that the life that we live right now, we live like we're enslaved. We're enslaved by money. We're enslaved by our jobs. We're enslaved by our lifestyle. We are enslaved by everything that we do. You know, most of our life is spent, you know, I've said this before on the show, and I'll keep on repeating it if I have to. I'll keep repeating it until it sinks in, until it gets through to everybody. You know, you walk up to your average person and tell them they're a slave, they'll tell you that, you know, you're crazy, you're ridiculous. Of course they're not slaves, they're free, they can go wherever, you know, I can go wherever I want to, I can do whatever I please, and, you know, all that. And they don't realize it. They do not realize the invisible shackles that's on them. And how are you enslaved? You're enslaved by your thinking. You're enslaved by, your view of the world, your view of authority and the way you think things work, the illusions that you believe, the lies that you, you take as the truth. And, you know, and the first thing that you need to do is you need to snap out of that prison. You need to get out of break out of the prison of the mind before you can affect anything. And I talk about a lot of scary things, and it is not lost on me that, you know, a lot of this could be instigating fear in my listeners. And as you all well know, or you should know by now, that fear is a very, very slow vibration, and it's very detrimental. And everything, I've said it before, I said on my last show, as a matter of fact, you know, I've said it on previous shows, that everything comes from either fear or love. There's only two emotions, really, and all the other emotions spring from those two. And I do not want to put people in a state of fear. And this is where I have a lot of misgivings about, how much do I go on about it? Do I yell and scream about it like Alex Jones? Do I jump up and down? Do I deliberately try to frighten you? No, I don't want to deliberately frighten you. I want you to be on notice. I want you to, you know, I bring up things and because I think it's something that should be, you know, pointed out to people. But I also want you to realize that fear and I'm glad I remembered this too, because I almost forgot to mention this. And I planned to mention this in the show, but you know, we bring up these topics and I don't want to make people worry. I don't want to drive people to distraction. I don't want anybody to lose any sleep over it. I do want people to take action though. And, one of the things that's vitally important, you know, and we started this off talking about manifestation, and I guess I'm going to wrap it up, talking about manifestation, is that, when you are constantly worried about something, you are creating that thing that you are so most worried about. You know, worrying is like praying for failure. Worrying is like praying for something that you don't want. It's like manifesting something that you do not want. And so to be in a state of fear and to worry about these things, what you're doing is you're calling these things to you. You're attracting these things to you. You have a choice. You can either draw to you or create or manifest or whatever you feel comfortable with, whatever way you know, of describing it, you feel comfortable with to draw those things to you. You want to attract the things that you need, the things that are positive for you, but it works both ways, you know, because when you're worried and you're in the moment and you're visualizing, you know, and you're living in the future and you're probably creating things that, may not have necessarily, arisen or came into being if you hadn't given it that power, you know, our ability to visualize, we have that for a reason. We have the ability to see pictures in our minds for a reason, because those images are powerful. And, you know, as Carl Jung would tell you, or anybody else who, spent any time at all delving into the secrets of our archetypes and our imagery and our symbols and everything else. Anybody who's done any kind of research into that will tell you that, those things are there for a reason. Those things are what you would refer to as magic in any other context, sorcery, whatever. We create through our imagery. We manifest things through our imagery. We have to visualize it in order to see it, to bring it into fruition. And your brain can't tell the difference. Your brain does not know, have any way at all of determining whether something that it imagines, it sees everything that it imagines as real. You know, everything is real to the brain. We've covered this before. And we're running out of time once again. Just let you chew that thought over and just be careful of the pictures that you put in your head and you know, put a lot of force or emotion behind, because you may be doing yourself a disservice. And when you feel fear, when you start to feel anxiety and everything, you know, just remember that you're manifesting something that you don't want. You're bringing that into your reality. And that's a good way to slap yourself and shift gears and into more of a positive mental projection. So anyway, we're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to R.P. Ruggiero, author of Brushfire Plague. So stick around. We'll be back in a second.
Preparing yourself for an emergency doesn't have to be all about doom and gloom. Getting all worked up about an impending disaster isn't going to better prepare you. It's just going to stress you out. Here at survival-gear.com, we believe your main goal when putting together a survival kit is to not just have the critical items you need in order to stay alive, but the right supplies in sufficient quantity to shield you from the effects of an extended unfortunate event. I like to say that if you have to use your survival kit, it should seem more like an impromptu camping trip rather than a dire emergency. Likewise, if a hurricane, earthquake, or tornado make your home unusable, you ought to be able to set up camp and still be relatively comfortable. Even during a survival scenario, staying warm, dry, hydrated, and fed doesn't have to seem like roughing it. At survival-gear.com, our goal is to better prepare you by providing full-fledged survival kits that you can absolutely count on. Visit survival-gear.com and check out our premium line of survival kits.
In an emergency situation, would you drink contaminated water? You could if you had the amazing LifeStraw from MyPatriotSupply.com. LifeStraw is the most advanced personal water filter available today. It filters contaminated water from almost any source. LifeStraw is lightweight and compact, perfect for hiking, camping, or in an emergency like a flood. LifeStraw is easy to clean, comes with a one-year warranty, and has been used worldwide since 2005. Get the amazing LifeStraw personal water filter at MyPatriotSupply.com. Plus, check out Survival Seed Vault. 20 seed varieties for only $37.95. Tattler canning lids. Long-term storable foods as low as $69.95. And much more at MyPatriotSupply.com. Enjoy stress-free shipping on all orders over $49. Call 866-229-0927 or visit MyPatriotSupply.com. That's 866-229-0927. MyPatriotSupply.com. For emergency preparedness, self-reliance, and food independence.
No one knows what the future holds, whether an unexpected natural disaster or a catastrophe of a more personal nature. You never know when you're going to need to call upon your survival skills and supplies. In order to be fully prepared, we at Dan's Depot believe you need two things in order to get through these uncertain times without fear: proven gear and top-notch survival training. DansDepot.com is not just another storefront selling survival gear. Our staff has been studying, practicing, and teaching survival skills for over four decades. We use and abuse all the gear we sell. So, when we recommend survival products, you can be assured that it's the highest quality gear available at the best price. But having the best gear means nothing if you don't know how to use it. That's why we have on-site video instructions to help you choose survival products for any situation. Each week, we produce new training videos and articles that inform, challenge, and better prepare you in all areas of survival, first aid, and self-reliance. Come visit us at DansDepot.com and let our team of survival experts help you get prepared with the knowledge and equipment you need to face these uncertain times with confidence. That's DansDepot.com.
Okay, and we're back, everybody, here on Survival and Beyond. And our next guest is the author of Brush Fire Plague. And this is the most recent, as far as I know, the most recent survival fiction or apocalyptic fiction novel that's been out. And the author is R.P. Ruggiero. And he's with us today, and we're going to talk about the book, and we're going to talk about some of the premises that were set forth in a survival context and all that other stuff. So I'm just going to stop babbling right now and welcome RP to the show. How you doing, RP?
I'm doing great, Ed. I really appreciate having you on. I'm real excited to talk with you about Brushfire Plague.
Yeah, it's great to have you on, and I'm about halfway through it right now, and it's a great read. And one of the things I thought was interesting about it is, you know, a lot of the survival fiction that you see out there, it's mostly about economic collapse or grid crash or something, you know, really tangible, I guess, for lack of a better word. And there's not a whole lot, you haven't seen a whole lot lately about pandemic and about, you know, biological disaster. And first of all, I'd like to find out why you use that as your premise. Is that something that you're concerned about yourself, and what was the thought process going on there?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, you know, we are actually overdue for another pandemic. They actually happen about every 50 years. Folks probably remember the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918. There was a much milder outbreak in the early 60s, I believe. And so we're sort of on the cusp of that next 50-year cycle. I think it is a real threat that folks need to be prepared for. It's definitely something I've thought about as a prepper. You know, that was definitely a big piece of it, and, you know, from my sort of preparation standpoint. And then just from the writer's perspective, you know, the virulent plague outbreak that happens in Brushfire Plague, you know, really does provide a good vehicle to sort of, you know, upend society and really, you know, show what can happen in that kind of situation. And that was something I've wanted to focus on. And I've, you know, been a, you know, a reader of apocalyptic fiction really since I was a child. And, you know, most of the books tend to focus on, in that genre anyway, focus on sort of, you know, 10 years later, 50 years later, you know, sort of after society sort of come apart at the seams. And I really did also want to focus on, you know, what was going to happen in the first days and weeks, and sort of show sort of the how society can break down, how a order can break down very quickly. And so that was really, the two reasons I wanted to, use the pandemic, as a survival crisis in Brushfire Plague.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is as likely a scenario as any. And, one of the things, kind of half jokingly, one of the questions I thought of is, do you know something that most of us don't know? Is there some kind of inside information you have?
No, I don't have any insider sort of information to share with your listeners. and quite frankly, with small kids of my own, I certainly hope that we live beyond the historical time frame of the 50 years, and it doesn't happen anytime soon. But it is, again, it's there. It's a real threat. I don't have any insider's information on that.
Right. Well, that's comforting to know in a way. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about your book, and your book focuses mostly your protagonist, Cooper Adams. He's not particularly a survivalist per se. I mean, he's handy with guns and he knows a thing or two, but he's not prepper, stockpiled, or prepped up or anything like that. And also his friend Dranko, who is the survivalist in the story, the survivalist character in the story. Why don't you tell us a little bit about them and what kind of people they are, what makes them tick, and how they react to the situation that they're finding them in the book.
Yeah, I mean, it's, Cooper Adams, really is, kind of the everyman kind of hero. He's an ordinary, mostly an ordinary guy. He's a father and a husband. He's a traveling salesman. And he's, he does have some experience, as you mentioned, that give him some useful, experience and skills to draw upon as he confronts this crisis. But, he really is just sort of your average person who has to step up in a, horrible situation where the plague is killing people at a very, very rapid rate, order collapses very quickly, chaos and violence sort of happen as a result of that. And he's really forced to deal with that. I really wanted to, have that kind of character be the main person, the protagonist, because, I think, a lot of the other books in the genre, most of which I read and enjoyed, it's not uncommon for that person to be a very skilled, either survivalist or, a lot of military experience. And so I felt like this would provide a different angle. I also wanted the main character to be someone that, everyone else can relate to, both preppers, survivalists, but also just average, readers who may not, read this genre or may not be into preparing themselves, because I feel like that provides a vehicle for those folks to connect with Cooper Adams. And that's the kind of feedback I've actually gotten from readers, that the fact that he is sort of your average person on the street, so to speak, really has provided himself often as Cooper Adams. He's an emotionally aware protagonist. He's aware of what's happening around him and of other folks' emotions, their morale, etc. And I really wanted to, draw those themes out as well.
And he's an honorable man. Yeah, he has a code of honor that he lives by.
Yeah. He's very principled in how he deals with things, and particularly around the issue of truth. And that's given, his background story is that his father's life was essentially destroyed by people lying about him, and he witnessed this happen as a young teenager. And so one of his principles is he never lies. He doesn't even white lies when it would be very convenient for him to do so. But beyond that, he lives a life of integrity, really does proceed with that set of principles. So I think, he's a pretty fascinating character. There's several different layers to him. And then, as you mentioned, Dranko, who's his good friend and neighbor, in the story, he really is the prepared person. He's a fairly serious survivalist. He does have some supplies that are useful to the neighborhood as they organize to defend themselves in terms of equipment and some weapons. He has an experienced base that the other folks need to get through this crisis. And then it was just an interesting day. So he's also a way that, readers and Cooper Adams are less about, things that they should be ready for, should have or need to think about going forward to get through the crisis. Mm-hmm. And then just another interesting play between these characters is, Cooper is an optimistic character, and on the other hand, is very cynical and pessimistic, as they have a lot of great interplay between those two people's world that I think add a lot to the story.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting that you chose not to highlight or to showcase Dranko as the main character, as the protagonist of the book. And one of the things that struck me in the book was that, when the crisis was happening, Dranko was telling Cooper, well, you better get to the supermarket and get some food and then go and, get gas and everything. And one of the thoughts that crossed my mind was, well, if he was his buddy, wouldn't he be telling him to stock up on this stuff a long time ago? But then on the other hand, you kind of think a guy like Dranko, he's probably stored up for both of them. He's already, prepared to take care of him and his family if he needs to.
I think that's definitely true. But then the other side to it is for example, on the weapons, Cooper had no idea his friend had all these things. And so it's also kind of a common situation, right, that you may not even share your extent of preparations with some of your closest friends.
Sure.
And so, but there are the moments that they refer back to for one of them, for example, is Paul Dranko had told his friend Cooper to get a military patent firearm, which he never did. And Cooper, of course, regrets that. But that's a great example because Dranko does then provide one. He did have a few extras on hand, to aid him. Of where he was. So, there's a lot of great interplay. As a writer, it provided a great way to, have the lessons, the sort of proper lessons sort of woven into the story. They don't often just sort of smack you upside the head. I really built them into the story, but it was a way to do that in a way that, doesn't detract from the story. Really adds to it, but does have those nuggets of good lessons to think about that I think survival fiction is one of the roles of it is to I know when I've read other books in the fiction category that they make you think about things you may not have been contemplating.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one other part, and I'm kind of hesitant to talk about the book too much because I don't want to give away any spoilers to our listeners, but one paradigm that was illustrated between Dranko and Cooper is when at one point Dranko was like, come on, we got to bug out, and Cooper's like, no way, I'm staying here, I'm not leaving my home, and they end up organizing the neighborhood, which I thought that was great. Like on one hand, I'm thinking, yeah, come on, ditch it, he can get out to his bug out spot, but then on the other hand, we're always talking about how important community is going to be in a situation, in a survival situation, in the end of the world as we know it scenario, and so I thought that was really rewarding that's the path they chose. It was to get their neighbors organized.
Yeah, no, it's really a central piece of the whole story, and that again goes to I wanted to tell that story of what it would take to confront your neighbors. We're at it's even this is a very deadly plague. I mean, some of the neighbors don't want to admit that stuff is going to happen. They have to get prepared to defend themselves. You have other ones, again, like Dranko, who wants to just leave. You have situations where people recognize, yes, we need to do something to defend ourselves, but no, we can't set up roadblocks, or barricades in our neighborhood. There's a lot of different levels of where people are at, and I think that's the story I wanted to tell there. That's what you're going to have to deal with. I mean, the reality is that you're going to have to deal with other people. You're going to have to sort of know where they're coming from, figure out how to, you know, bring them together for that common purpose, which, you know, there's a whole host of things. I mean, there's the issue of defense, there's the issue of, you know, dealing with food and water. I mean, all the different things that we would have to deal with in a crisis situation. It's, you know, all too often, I feel like, you know, the perspective on this, on the forums is that you'll just tell people what to do and they're going to swing into action. And that's just not reality.
Yeah.
You know, I think we all, from all of our lives, you know, our work lives and family life and, you know, the sports team's life. I mean, it's reality. But I think it gets ignored that somehow we think that in this kind of situation, which is much more stressful, or would be, you know, much more stressful, you know, those dynamics are certainly not going to go away. They're going to be exacerbated. And I really wanted to just kind of spotlight on that issue. And have them figure it out. And it's also, you know, that conflict between them is a huge source of tension between two very good friends, which, again, is something else that is not an unlikely scenario in these kind of situations. And I think so I wanted to tell that story, number one, because I think it's a very dramatic kind of story to tell. It's an interesting story to tell. But, again, from the preparations perspective, it really think, I'm hoping we'll have readers think about an area that they may not have been spending a lot of time thinking about, which is just how are you going to deal with other people in this kind of situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when you are dealing with disparate personalities and whatnot, you talk about the importance of what are known as soft skills and mm-hmm. and the kind of things like the conflict resolution and you know, knowing how to organize people and you know and just you know having leadership skills, you know, to a certain degree, and of course you need to have a degree of diplomacy as well.
That's right. And there's a lot of different levels to it. Some of it is pretty basic, like just giving everybody something to do is one way to help people deal, you know, not be focused on their fear, you know, put people, it gets the work done, but also serves a purpose of making panic and fear much less likely in the group you're dealing with, you know, all the way up to just, you know, dealing with egos that you're, you know, and how do you navigate getting people to do what needs to be done when they might have a different viewpoint of who's in charge here. And, you know, and that's something that Cooper has to navigate with another character, you know, Talvin Little, who's the elected president of the neighborhood association. So on mm-hmm. paper, he's the leader of this neighborhood, but obviously, you know, he's not well prepared to deal with this situation. So him and Cooper have a lot of conflict and tension, and Cooper has to figure out how to navigate, you know, that ego. And that's just another, you know, reality that you're going to have to deal with. So there's a lot of ways to, you know, I think another one I go to, another example in the story is negotiation. You know, I think and all too often, you know, all conflict is going to be resolved at the end of a barrel of a gun in the, you know, in our genre here. But I also feel like, you know, A, it's not realistic, and B, it's not the best approach, because if you can avoid a situation or de-escalate a situation without violence, that's a good thing. And the reason is anytime violence is going to happen, there's a risk to you, group you're with, you know, there's obviously, you know, resources are going to get used up. There's a lot of downside to that. And so, again, that's just another sort of skill set to be thinking about is how to negotiate in different situations. And there's an example of that in Brush Fire Plague that I thought was pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. Now, you wanted to talk a little bit about the character Lily Stott. And where I am in the book right now, she's only been kind of foreshadowed. I haven't really gotten to her much yet, but I'd like to hear a little bit about it, kind of like a sneak preview.
Yeah, so I fell in love with this character as I was writing, and she, you know, started out as a very bit player, almost like scenery, if you will, but really grew into more of a character as the story went on. And she's your sort of, you know, elderly woman from Kentucky, you know, very witty, you know, wit is sharp as a razor. And so she provides a lot of very wise, you know, observations. She doesn't say much, but what she says has a lot of power. And there's actually this great scene, and I won't spoil it for your readers, but it's later in the story, and they're, you know, Cooper is actually recommending that they use something, add something to their barricades that is very controversial. And so I'll be vague here not to give it away. It's very controversial with the number of the neighbors that are discussing it, and it looks like it's going to go not Cooper's way. And she steps in and sort of answers one of their questions in a very powerful way that moves the whole group to say, okay, yeah, we got to do this. And then they vote on it. And she, everybody's screaming, yes, let's do this. And then they call for the nays, and she's the one person that votes against it. And of course, everyone looks at her in shock. And she returns with this great, you know, basically returns by saying, yeah, we have to do this, but I'm voting no, so we know that we remember we're doing this with reluctance, and that's when we hold on to our humanity. So she's just this really, you know, great character that, it really just provides a lot of wisdom and these very witty statements that I think our readers will find many of them pretty memorable, you know, well beyond after they put Brush Fire Flag down.
Mm-hmm. So, apart from the community and, you know, and organizing and relying on the people around you, and as we all know that, you know, the lone wolf syndrome that's prevalent in the survival and preparedness realm just isn't going to fly. But apart from that, you know, are there any other particular survival lessons in Brush Fire Plague?
Yeah, well, there's a host of them. I mean, you know, there's obviously the issue of having a way to defend you know yourself, your supplies comes up. How do you having communication equipment is one of the issues I draw out as well. And then, you know, just the notion of ready, the fact that, you know, having some preparations goes a long way is sort of also built into the story. And so there's kind of multiple lessons. I tried to, on that front, what I was really trying to do was, have enough in there that everybody would get something from it in terms of walking with at least a few, lessons that people hadn't been thinking about. But this is, you know, it's not a story that, that has a survival lesson on every single page. I mean, it's not a survival manual in, you know, in novel format or that nature. And I think I sort of, you know, what's been great when I put, the, you know, when I sort of released it to the market, you know, I was very confident people, read this genre would enjoy it. And what's really been great hearing the feedback, you know, on the Amazon reviews and the people that have emailed me and the ones who've spoken with me, and then also the professional reviews that have happened. What's been really great is, you know, there's just a wide spectrum this has appealed to. So, you know, folks who've heard this genre have really enjoyed it, and it's provoked them to think about preparing for the very first time. And that's been, you know, one of the most rewarding things for me to hear. People again who you know read this genre a lot have really enjoyed it. Even, you know, sort of the end of the spectrum, who've read everything there is to read, very dedicated survivalists, you know, I've heard from many of them to say, you know, there was again at least a few things built, you know, that they came away with that they hadn't been thinking about. And so that kind of piece, those kind of pieces of feedback have been really rewarding to hear, that, you know, everyone's sort of getting something out of this story on the sort of preparation front. And so I'm sure I'm forgetting a few other lessons that are woven into it, but
yeah, I don't mean to put you on the spot or anything, like be the guru right now.
Yeah. And it's got a good balance. I mean, one of the other things that's been just great to hear from folks is that people said, oh, you struck this good balance or perfect balance between, you know, the action part of it, the emotional side, the character development, the survival lesson built in. So, right. I think a lot in there for, you know, different readers obviously will take different things away from it. But, you know, it's been great to hear that feedback.
Oh, sure, and it's a fine line to walk. I'm sure that I would find that daunting myself. You know, I mean, there are some examples of survivalist fiction or apocalyptic fiction where the survival information kind of gets in the way of the narrative. You know, or it gets in the way of the story, the pacing. You know, so it's I can imagine it's a difficult thing to do to put in enough and make your points and get some information across that's useful to people, as well as, you know, tell a compelling story. Did you have to do a lot of research? I imagine you did, you know, do research into pandemics and what the likelihood is. So you made sure that everything was, you know, legit and realistic.
Yeah, you know, I did some research. I mean, the stuff I focused on was on the sort of some of the sort of military tactics, if you will. That was an area I hadn't known a lot about. You know, having been a prep for myself for the past 7 or 8 years, you know, that realm, I've spent, you know, countless hours doing research well before I ever thought about writing a book on that front. I'm a firearms enthusiast, so I sort of know to, you know, present a credible, you know, narrative about how guns operate, you know, the different, you know, different uses, different calibers, that sort of information.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then on the interpersonal dynamics, I mean, and sort of, you know, how to bring people together and deal with all these stressful situations. You know, I have experience of that on sort of my day job, if you will. But yeah, mostly focused on that. There was different moments I'd looked up to make sure I was representing different equipment correctly, that sort of thing. But, you know, for the most part, it was sort of, my background thus far, I think, really did prepare me to write this story in a credible way, in a real way. And that's again, I think, within survivalist fiction, it has to be realistic, or people are just going to throw a trash heap. And so I think it's, you know, it's been read by enough people to sort of pass that test. But it is, you know, going back to your earlier point, it definitely is a balance of telling a good story and then having valuable information built in that doesn't sort of, you know, detract from or overtake the story. And, you know, the way that I approached that was, I really did, you know, I set out first and foremost, I wanted to write a good novel, and then build up the other lessons into it around that. And part of the reason for that is I just feel like survival fiction, one of the key roles it can play, you know, is to get people, again, who aren't thinking about this, realm of being prepared, et cetera, to think about it. I think survival fiction can really play a good role. You know, I think we all have either reluctant spouses, family members, friends who we wish we could make the light bulb go off for them. And this is, you know, survival fiction is one means to do that. And, you know, I had that very personal experience with my wife about 6 years ago. You know, I've been into preparing for a couple years. She wasn't fully understanding it, you know, and I had to, you know, talk through things, but she ended up reading, I had to read actually Octavia Butler's Parable of the Talents, which is a great sort of apocalyptic story. And that made that helped the light bulb go off for her. And so that was also in my mind as I sat down to write Brush Sharp Flag, to have a story like that that could pull in people who aren't already, you know, in with us, if you will. And sort of have it accomplish that sort of task or goal as well.
Yeah, and that's something that's important. That's something that I'm always trying to do, and with my writing, my work for the magazine, and also the show is, you know, I think it's important to preach to the choir, but it's also more important to wake more people up and get them more aware of the fact that you know, they need to be prepared and they need to have some survival skills. So, and that's a great way to do it. That's one of the questions that comes up a lot. It's like, you mentioned the reluctant spouse, you know, she's not on board or he's not on board or skeptical or whatever, you know, and, you know, we're always, that's a question I always get bounced around. It's like, well, how do you get your spouse on board? How do you approach your neighbors with, you know, these kinds of things? And, you know, you kind of have to do it gently. And this is one way of doing it.
Absolutely. I think because it's non-threatening. It's, you know, again, you can hand, you know, these folks, neighbors, spouse, et cetera, a novel that's in this genre and hopefully turn them on to think about these issues. Whereas if you give them a straight-up survivalist manual, you know, they're going to look at you funny, or they're never going to pick it up to read it. And so I do think that is one of those, you know, functions of survivalist literature is to do that, as well as entertain and inform and broaden, you know, our horizons or lessons we need to learn for those of us who are into it. That is, you know, the value spaces, if you will, that survivalist fiction operates in. And I just think there's a lot of other, you know, beyond survival fiction, there are a lot of other ways to get people, you know, open their eyes to thinking about these issues, you know, who aren't currently.
Mm-hmm. What is your primary concern as a prepper right now? And say we'll put the pandemic issue aside, but apart from that, what are you anticipating the most?
Well, the two things beyond, you know, pandemics, for me, it's always just natural disasters. They exist in every area. You know, I think that's a very likely scenario that there's always happening in some part of the world. And, you know, it's about time before that sort of spinner hit where we might be. So that's number one. And then number two, I think certainly with the economic environment continues to be very uncertain. And, you know, we're always sort of a couple bad. I feel like we're always a couple bad events away from, you know, a pretty severe depression or you know, bigger collapse. And so those are really the two things that I think beyond pandemics that are sort of in my mindset. You know, I try to follow the saying behind it now, but you know, spend 80% of your time on what's most likely to happen. You know, I just believe in that methodology that start from a place of what do you think are, you know, and everyone has to make their own judgment on this, but whatever you think is most likely, prepare for that first, and then sort of move out from there to less, maybe as you see it, less likely. And that's sort of, you know, my sort of, you know, modus operandi, if you will, leveraging my preparations.
Mm-hmm. Yep, you can't prepare for everything, although a lot of different events you prepare for in exactly the same way. So that's one thing. You can have yourself covered in many different areas. And also, like you say, you know, depends on where you live. Some places are more likely than others to have, you know, like one of the things that I always refer to is when the tidal wave, the tsunami, you know, hit Japan, and the commentators were, you know, always remarking that it could have been a lot worse had the Japanese people not been preppers, had they not been as prepared as they were. And it's like, well, yeah, they live in an earthquake zone, you know. But, you know, they stored water and they had food stored. And for the most part, I mean, there was still mad rush on grocery stores and people were accusing each other of hoarding and, you know, those who were prepared. But, yeah, and that's another interesting issue that you have to deal with in the context of brush fire plague, is that you've got a lot of people in your neighborhood and they're all at various degrees of preparedness. Some are not prepared at all, and I haven't gotten far enough into the book where there was really a big conflict over how resources are distributed, or you know how they handle the food situation or anything like that. But what are your recommendations in a group setting? We'll just put it on R.P. Ruggiero, not as speaking as a character from the book, so you don't have to give away any spoilers. But how do you work that kind of problem out?
Yeah, well, I think the first place is it depends on you know, how long you're confronted with. You know, so for example, if it has been a sort of localized natural disaster, you know, within a few weeks, you know, I think it's reasonable to depend upon aid coming. You know, certainly not in the first few days, we've learned that with Katrina,
right.
But certainly it's been a few weeks. So in that situation, you know, I would be sharing a lot of my, you know, stored supplies with my neighbor, because it's, at that point, it's not a threat to me or my family, and I'm going to help everybody else get through. So that's a very different scenario if, you know, it's complete economic collapse and, you know, you have no idea when the trains and the trucks are running again. I think in that situation, you're going to have to, really again start with protecting you and yours first. And I subscribe to the notion of the anonymous charity. If you see those in desperate need and you do have something you can spare, doing anonymously, that was one of the things I know I picked up from reading the work by Rawls, was that concept is the first place I'd heard it, and I do subscribe to that. So I think it really is going to depend on the situation. Obviously long term, you're going to have to sort of form your, close knit group that can, adequately defend themselves and, everyone. And that's sort of what's the setup in Brush Fire Plague is, there is some sharing that happens. There's some Fort food resource issues. The next sentence of the book, because the Brush Fire Plague really takes place from the first 2 weeks of this happening. I will, give a little foreshadowing to the sequel. Those kind of issues are going to emerge more as obviously supplies get exhausted. But that's, in the Brush Fire Plague, they are sharing their resources, and figuring out ways to procure more. And in fact, that's one of the, one of the ways they deal with that is an adjoining neighbor that has access, secured a big food store actually in crisis first outbreak, they actually trade some firearms that they have a few extras of for some of the food supplies from that adjoining neighborhood, and so that's one of the solutions that they use in the story. So I think it really depends on the situation, and what resources are available where you are. Obviously, this is very different if you're in a suburban setting or an urban setting versus up in a rural setting. So I think everyone's going to have to answer those differently. I think the some of the fundamental principles that apply, is to share when you can, but also then, you're going to have to make some hard decisions on that position, and you are going to have to sort of circle the wagons and keep enough that you're going to get through. You and those that you're working with are going to get through that crisis. That's 2 weeks or a year or longer.
Right. So it's official. There is going to be a sequel to Brush Fire Plague.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm in the process of writing it now. And so I'm trying to, my target date is to make sure it comes out within 1 year of Brush Fire Plague, which would be kind of mid to late summer. It's going really well so far, so I'm a little optimistic it might come out earlier, but that's what I'm working on. So I'm pretty excited about it. I've actually now mapped out a trilogy to the Brush Fire Saga, and that one of the fun parts is again some of the, on the feedback front, a lot of people say, when's the sequel coming out? And well, I've got, I'm not going to write it. I mean, I take both my preparations pretty seriously, but I take my writing seriously as well. And I'm not going to just rush and get something out there just to satisfy that demand. I really do want to make sure I turn out another, engaging, riveting story that's a fast read, but for readers to be able to follow the continued travails and adventures and all the rest of it with Cooper and the rest.
Mm-hmm. So it'll be contemporaneous. It'll pick up where Brush Fire Plague left off.
Yeah, I mean, what I did with Brush Fire Plague is that it does have to, it closes the story, but it's not one of these where nothing gets resolved. Actually, the big issue that happens around the mystery of how Brush Fire started does get resolved, but then I left, the door was left open to a sequel, and that's that is what I'm going to write, or I'm writing. It picks up from the next morning, so cool. when the Brush Fire Plague ends.
Right. Well, RP, it was great to have you on the show, and again, I'm really enjoying the book. I'm still making my way through it when I can get some time off of my schedule. It seems I'm always working, but I highly recommend the book to our listeners. I think you'll really dig it. It's called Brush Fire Plague, and you can get it. Where can they get it?
Yeah, the easiest place is Amazon.com. It's available in trade paperback and also for the Kindle reader. If you've got a Nook reader, or for dealing with Barnes & Noble, it's also at bn.com. And then just a couple other quick places for people to get more information. You can go to the website I've set up for it, which is really easy. It's www.brushfireplug.com. You can certainly follow me on Twitter, Facebook page set up as well. If you're on Facebook, they can like the Brushfire page, and that's actually the best way, either that or through Twitter, if folks want to stay up to date on any future news about the book and the sequel. Those are easy places where we can stay connected. But yeah, again, the simplest place is Amazon.com or BN.com for Barnes & Noble. Yeah, I just want to thank you for having me on the show. It's been great talking with you, and I definitely want to hear from you when you've finished it. And I'd particularly love to hear what you thought of the ending, because I think you'll enjoy it. But I definitely want to hear from you on it.
Oh yeah, yeah, I definitely will. I'll probably want to talk to you about it again and pick your brain about the sequel. And we'll have you back on when that's ready to come out as well. It's been great talking to you.
More than happy. I appreciate it.
Well, that'll just about do it for this installment of Survival and Beyond. I want to thank you all for listening. And until next week, as usual, keep your head up, keep on living free, and don't take any crap from anybody. And you are the co-creator of your own reality. Don't forget it. Live it, learn it, love it, swim it, sleep it. It's the truth. Take care, everybody. See you next week.